University of Colorado.
Welcome to You on the Air. As we navigate the coronavirus, there's a great need for frank discussions about psychiatric disorders as the second surge of this pandemic hits us. Today on See You on the Air, we're talking with Dr. Neil Epperson, professor and chair of the Department of Psychiatry in the University of Colorado School of Medicine. We're talking with her about her weekly podcast, Mind the Brain, which explores the many aspects of mental health during the COVID-19 pandemic. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Epperson.
Well, thank you, Ken, and please call me Neil.
I will. You had an interesting journey getting here. Just a little background. Tell us how you got from Yale to the University of Colorado.
Well, it was a little bit of a circuitous path. I mean, I was raised in North Carolina, so I attended UNC Chapel Hill for both undergraduate and medical school. And so I really think I have a state institution in my blood and a public health mission instilled in me when I was at UNC. But I did my residency at Yale, and my husband and I wound up with jobs there. It's kind of hard for two psychiatrists to get a job, both of us to get jobs at academic medical centers. So we stayed, and I really built a research career and clinical program at that institution. Then got enticed away in 2009 to the University of Pennsylvania, where I really felt like I could have a larger impact in a community, providing mental health services, particularly as they relate to some women's health issues and integrated care. I stayed at Penn for 9 years, and then the University of Colorado came calling. And once again, I felt like this was just too good an opportunity, and I have not looked back. I think it's an amazing institution. I've made colleagues here on campus at the CU Anschutz campus, but also at CU Boulder and down at the CU in Colorado Springs. And so I just really love the whole University of Colorado system.
We're happy to have you here. Two psychiatrists married, I wonder.
Don't talk to our children. No, they would be the first to say, kid, because their friends ask them. They say, you know, I actually am a well-adjusted person.
You probably say the old joke, if it's not one thing, it's your mother.
Yeah, I do get blamed for a number of things in the household, but.
So you got into the podcasting game yourself in late April. What inspired you to start Mind the Brain?
That's a really kind of interesting question that I've been pondering, because it's been a lot of fun to do Mind the Brain. And but the sort of original thought about it was that we have so much expertise here in the Department of Psychiatry at the CU Anschutz campus. And then most recently, we've been doing a series of guests from the CU Boulder programs. And so we've had a wonderful number of clinician scientists, to be able to speak about the kind of stress that we're experiencing, this kind of unprecedented stress that keeps going and going and going. We have no idea when it ends. A lot of people are feeling really out of control. And again, this kind of social isolation. And usually, as human beings, we manage our stress a lot of times by social interaction. And we're a social species. And so I just knew early on in the pandemic that this was going to be a tough one for us as human beings, and that there were going to be many, many people that weren't going to be able to manage their stress in the same way that they had before, and that social contact was not going to be one of the ways that people could cope with some of the things that they're dealing with. And so we spent a lot of time early on with the department building opportunities for resilience training and support. We did a number of team support sessions for frontline clinicians over at the University of Colorado Hospital. We also reached out to Highlands Ranch. And what we were hearing and seeing is that a lot of people really responded well to the support, but there were a number of people who really needed more formal mental health care. And the evidence is pretty clear from, you know, traumatic situations. Again, we've never been in a pandemic before like this, but in other traumatic situations like post-Katrina or post-9/11, that there's a delay a lot of times in seeking mental health care. and people would develop depression later or PTSD symptoms later, get into problem alcohol use, for example. And, you know, I thought about what we were messaging, and we were messaging, okay, here's tools to help be resilient. But, you know, particularly people that are high powered and, you know, working at the top of their field, if they needed mental health care, they probably wouldn't seek it because the message is that they're not being resilient. And so I was really concerned that people were equating resilience with not getting depressed or resilience with not developing insomnia or alcohol problems, because some of the most resilient people I know have suffered from pretty severe mental illness and serious mental illness. And so I just didn't want people to stop thinking about mental illness and that the buzzword resilience would ultimately backfire and keep people from seeking help, mainly because of the stigma of, quote unquote, I must not be resilient if I need to seek mental health care. So it was really to build that concept of, you know, we need to talk about mental illness, not just resilience.
What kind of feedback have you been getting about the podcast?
Well, overall, people seem to find it very accessible. I've worked really hard to make sure that the questions that we address on the air, as well as the written document that's on our website that's linked to the podcast, includes information about mental illness and stress and coping strategies, but very specifically helping people understand what about what we're going through right now is likely to trigger mental illness, depression, anxiety, what have you, even in people who've never experienced these symptoms before. And I think if people have a better understanding of the underlying causes and why this situation, this unprecedented, uncontrollable, or seemingly uncontrollable stress that we're experiencing is just like a perfect storm for creating an increased risk for mental health issues. And so we've really taken each session and whatever the topic is, whether it was depression or OCD or alcohol use, or recently we just did one with Rosie Kaiser from CU Boulder on brain development and depression in adolescence and early adulthood. But we just work to provide practical information and practical tips that people can then take away. And that's the kind of message I've been getting from our listeners, that they appreciate that it's somewhat of a soundbite. It's not too long. We're not talking over people's heads. and that, you know, we're really just trying to provide, you know, as much as we possibly can. This is what works under these situations. Again, this is a situation like no other, but this is what typically works when we're in a situation where we have a lot of unknowns.
It seems like even before the pandemic, there was an increased drumbeat awareness about mental health issues. Do you think that was because there's greater awareness, because there's greater incidence, both?
Well, I mean, I think that overall, there is definitely greater awareness. And that's some, I know various groups around the state of Colorado and at the CU Anschutz campus have, I think for years been promoting greater understanding of mental health and mental illness. And, you know, I want to kind of give out a shout out to our colleagues at the Johnson Depression Center, because I do feel that they have done a tremendous job with a number of their community outreach programs to help to destigmatize the idea of seeking mental health care. One does not have to have a serious mental illness in order to seek mental health care. And ideally, you seek it before the situation becomes serious. And so how do we get information out so that people know that what they're experiencing may be something that they should seek help for? I do know that Governor Polis, I also appreciate that mental health is something that he thinks a lot about in this state. My previous governor, Governor Wolf, back in Pennsylvania, also had a proclivity to want to support particularly substance use issues and opioid dependence in the state of Pennsylvania. But I think that Governor Polis has here been very more general in trying to think about how to transform the mental health system in all of Colorado so that it works more effectively, more efficiently, and makes the patient and provider experience one that is much more positive and effective. So he created this past year the Behavioral Health Task Force, and I've had the privilege to sit on that task force and really learn as a newbie to Colorado. I've been here just shy of 2 years. To be able to learn more about how does mental health care function and how is it funded? What are the programs that we have here in the state? What's working and what's not working? So I think that we live in a unique state where many stakeholders, and that's one of the things that attracted me to come here. We also have donors to the University of Colorado School of Medicine, the Department of Psychiatry, UCH and Children's Hospital, who are just so forward-thinking that they recognize that we have to have mental health if we're going to have health in our state. And so I also want to give a shout out to a number of our various supporters and donors to the institution, and particularly the Department of Psychiatry, because we couldn't do this work without them, and I am so grateful.
You touched on a few of the topics that have been perhaps exacerbated by COVID-19, alcohol use, OCD, resilience issues. But what are some of the particular issues that are driven by this pandemic or magnified by the pandemic?
When we realized that was going to happen, we went into overdrive because, I mean, I've studied human behavior long enough to know that social connectedness, you know, it's hormonally driven. We get a little shot of oxytocin when we have wonderful, close, intimate relationships with people that we care about. And there is a relationship between stress and oxytocin, for example. So when one is stressed, you get a shot of cortisol, that kind of stress hormone, but you also get a little shot of oxytocin. It's kind of like the nature's way of saying, hey, you do need to be stressed about this, but we don't want you to be overly stressed. And so I think it's something
where do
that,
I get some of that?
Where do you get some of that? I know. I'm starting to think of maybe we should do a clinical trial with some oxytocin. But the bottom line is that we knew that as mental health care providers, and I've studied hormone effects on the brain my entire career, and I recognized that this was going to be a major challenge. And so we really focused on how can we help people think about getting connected with one another? How do they stay connected? And then if they're not living with somebody, sort of how can they be in contact with people outside of their home? And, you know, again, we're trying to message this in a safe way that is consistent with different policies that have been put forth in the state across the past few months. But we do encourage people to make sure that they have those kinds of connections. It's one of the reasons that we provide the support groups, because we want people to process, particularly our frontline clinicians, we want them to be able to process what's happening to them together, because that togetherness is so important. We've also received funding now from FEMA, as well as the Office of Behavioral Health, to extend some of the work that the department has been doing here on campus to the rest of the state. So we now have a program that is called Past the Pandemic. I actually think that that's a very optimistic title because we're not past the pandemic yet, but it is kind of looking forward and say there is life past the pandemic, and we're here to help you with various support groups that we can offer to hospitals and primary care programs across the state. We have a doc-to-doc line because we found that doctors are not very good at reaching out for help. So we're trying to figure out creative ways to get our friends and physicians to reach out for help. And so in any case, there's a lot going on and there's a lot that we need to be doing more.
On your Mind the Brain podcast, your topics are pretty direct, sometimes uncomfortable, always important. How do you determine what you're going to talk about?
Well, it's based upon what we know about the factors that I was just describing, the need for human contact. How do we manage stress? When stress is unpredictable and chronic, what parts of us start to deteriorate? So our sleep, for example. So we did one on sleep because obviously that's one of the things that a lot of people are having difficulty with. The impact on children and adolescents and young adults. We know that there's been many people that have had to forgo graduation. They didn't have a prom. They weren't able to finish school with their friends. Parents all of a sudden found themselves at home working and also trying to manage, you know, homeschooling for their children. And it's unbelievable. I mean, the level of stress that must produce is just, I think, unbelievable. And, you know, a lot of people were worried about finances. So we really focused on the kinds of problems that we knew people were experiencing. A lot of our material came from doing the support groups with frontline providers and hearing what they were concerned about. And these could have been nurses, social workers, chaplains, nutritionists, dietary, you know, aides in the hospital, respiratory therapists. It was pretty much everyone except for physicians. We only had a handful of physicians out of over 500 people. again, we're still trying to figure out how to reach our MD colleagues, but I'll put in a plug for our doc-to-doc line so they can have a private phone call with another clinician who hopefully we'll be able to help them in a private manner if that's what is keeping them from seeking help. But one of the things that we think is keeping people from seeking help is that they're just go, 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 go. And they're really just trying to get through the acute phase of this pandemic because it's now dragging on and we're starting to see sort of an uptick in cases even here in Colorado. I think that the depression, the anxiety, the insomnia, some of the PTSD symptoms, because if you were traumatized a lot during those first few months and then now it's kind of decreased, all of a sudden it comes back again. That's sort of almost like a re-traumatization. So we know that from other studies of, again, natural disasters and those kinds of things, you know, some people don't present for at least a year because they don't recognize exactly what's happened to them. And that's one of the other reasons why we talk on Mind the Brain. You know, we're trying to get people to think about these as brain illnesses and brain problems, that you can't go through a huge level of stress and not have your brain affected. The brain produces the mind and that sense of who you are. Often the brain doesn't get stigmatized, but the mind does. So if we can get people shifting and understanding that this is a medical issue, just like anything else, I mean, you wouldn't feel stigmatized if your heart had a hard time through the pandemic, but people do feel stigmatized when it comes to their brain.
You have a wealth of expertise there, not just in your department, the Department of Psychiatry, but the School of Medicine at CU Anschutz, and you mentioned at Boulder. How do you pick your guests for each episode?
Well, one of the things that we focused first are people who have expertise in these particular areas. So someone who has expertise in disaster relief, that was our very first one, because, you know, nobody knew how to compare this kind of stressor with previous like natural disasters or 9/11. And so Dr. Stephen Berkowitz was our first guest because, you know, he had spent a lot of time when we lived in Connecticut at the time. Yes, he is my husband. I did my first podcast on my husband. He was my guinea pig. But when we were living in Connecticut when 9/11 occurred, and as a child and adolescent psychiatrist, he did a lot of work, not only in New York, but also in Connecticut, in thinking about disaster preparedness for children. But then we talked about suicide because, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, we must have an uptick in suicide. And again, I think that there are certain risk factors that also do increase the risk of suicidal behavior during this time. But we're just trying to bring things to the fore, talking about them, like I said, very honestly, helping people to understand them in such a way that they recognize these as medical problems and that it's nothing to be ashamed of if you feel like you need more help. And it doesn't mean that you're not resilient. Think about that term resilience, you know, and people talk about the tree, you know, beautiful tall tree could look super resilient because it's so like magnificent and everything. But then, you know, a strong wind comes and blows it down. Well, maybe it was never tested by strong wind. The only way you know that that tree is resilient or not resilient is if it's stressed. It has to be stressed by a wind or some other kind of perturbation like that. So I think the same thing when it comes to mental health issues, that so many of the strongest people I know have this as a medical condition they've had to overcome. It's like overcoming cancer, or it's like dealing with a chronic medical condition or dealing with chronic pain. Just because you have pain or just because you have a medical condition doesn't mean you're not resilient. It's what you do with it and how you manage it. That, and sometimes it's harder to manage than others, and we want people to have self-compassion. That was actually one thing I told myself I wanted to talk to you about, Ken. If you think about, and if anybody is actually out there and has listened to all the Mind the Brain podcasts, I think one theme that comes across quite frequently is this concept of having compassion for ourselves and for others, that this is, no one has a leg up on an experience on how to manage this pandemic. This is new to everybody, and that we're all going to have a reaction to it. And it's not always going to be a positive reaction. And how do you have compassion for yourself and for others so that you're patient and kind and cut yourself a little bit of slack that, you know, this is hard and that it's going to be a tough slog through the rest of this pandemic?
Compassion is a greatly underrated quality in my view.
Oh, yes. I try to practice it frequently and I'm not always successful.
I'm going to cut myself some slack.
Yes, please do. Ken, I'll cut you some slack.
When you started Mind the Brain, you said it would go for several weeks, and you're beyond that. What's your plan? Are you going to continue with these?
Probably what I will be doing is moving towards more of a general Mind the Brain and not focusing solely on COVID. I think it's time for us to start to think about some other aspects of the brain and the mind. I'd like to get to some more lived experience and talking to people with lived experience. It's particularly potent, I think, to talk to people who are clinicians with lived experience because they can kind of see it from both sides. And, you know, this is Minority Mental Health Month, the month of July. And so I'm doing two special podcasts really to recognize the particular issues and mental health issues that face minorities in our state and in our country. So I'll be doing one on racism and how particularly malignant racism is when it comes to mental health. And I will also be doing one on refugee and immigrant mental health, because Aurora has, this whole community has a large number of refugees and immigrants. And I think it's really important to think about their lived experience and what that brings with respect to their mental health or risk for mental illness.
You talked about trauma and mental health, and obviously to further the Minority Mental Health Month, there's been a lot of protests, a lot of social unrest lately. Do you see particular mental health issues related with what's going on in the country and around the world?
Well, I do, Ken. So I'm glad you asked that question. It's interesting because we've been talking to even colleagues at work, individuals of color, and you know that Colorado, we only have about 10% Blacks in Colorado, and I think maybe something like 15% Hispanic or Latinx populations. And then again, like I said, a large refugee population, and they're from all over the world. And so, you know, when I think about the fact that there's like 130 languages spoken in the Aurora school or dialects in the Aurora school district, it just boggles my mind. And so, you know, when it comes to the current unrest, specifically focusing on racism and, you know, what happened recently with the police and the death of Mr. Floyd, we have to have more conversations about race. I mean, one of my colleagues said to me that she said, I've worked on campus for many years, and this is the first time people have actually talked to me openly and honestly about race. And it blew my mind. I really had no idea that that was her lived experience. And so In the Department of Psychiatry, I actually appointed that particular individual as one of our leaders in our diversity, equity, and inclusion programming for the department. And we've also created a whole program on diversity, equity, and inclusion that we did not have as a department. And I felt like that was very important, particularly given what was going on in our country. But I find that people are very torn. I have clinicians and other people in the department that are actually married to people in law enforcement, and they feel badly for their family member because, you know, they feel like the fact that they're in law enforcement, that must mean that people think they're a racist or what have you. And they feel, and that's causing them a lot of stress, and they worry about the safety of their partners. But, you know, at the same time, we have structural racism and systemic racism in our country that is pervasive, you know, and when you see what's going on in the nation, I know a lot of people are very stressed by it, and they do feel that they too have been targeted. Racist events have targeted them as well. So I guess what I'm wanting to get across with these sort of special podcasts is that we have to recognize that racism, it has affected generation after generation. And we know that there's intergenerational transmission of stress. That's something that I and my colleagues have studied. And that intergenerational transmission of stress has adverse effects, not only on people and their psychology, but their body, their whole body, not just their brain, but metabolism, immune function. And we're just learning about this and sort of striking the tip of the iceberg and understanding the actual health consequences of racism. But they are real, and they affect numerous organ systems. And so we have a lot to do to help the people that are experiencing these problems now, but also to move forward so that we can break this intergenerational transmission. I just don't see us doing it this generation, unfortunately. I'm hopeful, but we've got a lot of work to do.
Yes, we do. It seems like, you know, with social unrest, protests, the pandemic, the economy, any one of these issues by itself is a lot for people to cope with. And the combination of them is a tremendous amount. Does that combination effect make things worse, harder to deal with, harder to address as a psychiatrist?
Well, I think as a psychiatrist working with an individual, you obviously want to understand that person's lived experience and what is really potent to them. You know, I was talking with a family member last evening, and for him, the pandemic has actually not been so horrific because of his job, and he has a more stable job now. But his friend is feeling very depressed and really kind of hopeless about the situation. But his situation is very different than this other individual. And so I think you have to sit down and study and really talk to the individual to understand sort of what part of all of this morass of stress is particularly potent for that individual. Because if you allow it to just be this morass of stress, you know, like so many different things, and you don't actually get down to the specifics, it is very hard to be able to help that person figure out strategies. Again, they may be imperfect, but strategies for coping with what they're most concerned about. And then it may go to what they're less concerned about once they've been able to address what they're most concerned about. Obviously, for some people, if you're a frontline clinician, early on, it was a lot of stress and worry about getting sick, being able to take care of patients and keep them from dying, and then bringing home the illness to your family. They had jobs. They definitely had jobs, and they knew that they had money. So it wasn't a financial stress. That wasn't the biggest part for them. The biggest part was the contamination and the worries about being sick or getting a family member sick.
As we talked about a little bit, some of the topics in mind the brain are a little uncomfortable, but obviously have to be discussed. One of those, suicide risk. And some are predicting a higher rate of suicide during the pandemic. You had Dr. Michael Allen on, who offered some insight into how people can help with that.
Yes. And we have to not be afraid to say the word suicide. And we have to be like this. My family member, when he was talking about his friend, he said to me, he said, did I say the right thing to him? Should I have said something else? And I thought that that was so, I mean, this is a 28-year-old kid. His birthday is today. young adult. And I was so impressed that that was what he was wanting to think about. And unfortunately in his life, he had a friend commit suicide or actually with serious mental health problems. And so he was very acutely aware that of what serious mental health issues look like. He asked his friend, how are you doing? Is there anything I can do for you? Is there any problem? Are you worried about anything in particular that you just want to hash out with me? And then I said to him, I said, look, if he still seems really down and is having a tough time, you ask him, have you thought to go talk to someone? There's no shame in it. There's no embarrassment in it. You can even do it through telehealth now. You don't even have to walk into a doctor's office. You can actually do it through Zoom. And I think that actually telehealth is going to be a way in which we can decrease some of the stigma related to mental illness, because young people particularly are very comfortable with the video chatting kind of mechanism and platform. So I'm hopeful that using telehealth and having that as an option will help people that may be really struggling reach out sooner, because we don't want them to get to the point where they're starting to think about life is not worth living, or maybe I'd be better off dead. And then to start thinking about methods for harming themselves. And so we have to talk about suicide. We have to be very clear that if somebody in your life, it looks like they're really struggling and depressed, you need to ask them. just ask them, say, you know, how depressed are you? Are you thinking about harming yourself? And truthfully, people want you to ask.
Yeah.
Yeah, they do. They do want you to ask.
It's like a simple intervention.
Yes, yes. And then basically, you know, we have hospitals, we have emergency rooms, we have urgent care centers, primary care doctors. I mean, there are definitely people to reach out to. We have a suicide or a crisis hotline. It's not a suicide hotline. It's a crisis hotline here in Colorado. And it's a very active program, and they definitely know the right way to get you to help.
Another one of your episodes focused on alcohol abuse, and you had Dr. Patrick Failing of the Center for Dependency, Addiction, and Rehabilitation on the campus, talking about how the pandemic affected some of his patients and the overall rise in alcohol use. What were some of the takeaways there?
Well, I think one of the big takeaways from that particular episode was, it was even called Mind the Drink. I actually think that that was a really clever title. I loved it. Because one of the things that he talked about, Dr. Failing, was that we need to be mindful of how much we drink. When we're in social situations and we have to drive home, for example, or we're with friends where we're being observed, we have more of a tendency to observe ourselves as well. And we also have the brakes on how much we drink, because people are watching us, so we don't want to embarrass ourselves. Two, you have to get home. You don't want to be in a situation where you feel like you can't drive. And those kinds of just really subtle or not so subtle sort of external factors can help you be more mindful of how much you're drinking. But when you're at home and you're just watching TV, maybe you're watching movies and that kind of thing, and, you know, say if you drink a little bit too much, you just kind of go up to bed and whatever, you know. And so that can be a very slippery slope to drinking more than you anticipate and drinking more than that you're recognizing. So one of the tips that Dr. Failing mentioned was thinking not so much about sort of how much you drank that night, but how quickly you go through whatever alcohol you happen to like. You know, so if you like wine, are you going through a whole bottle? Well, that's actually about 5 glasses of wine, particularly for anyone sitting. 5 glasses is not recommended by the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse. And so that's considered a binge, actually. So he really did talk a lot more about just trying to plan when you drink, try to focus on whether you're drinking for stress relief. And then if you choose to drink, paying attention to how much you're taking in, because it's just so easy when you're home. I think I'll have another glass, you know, We've all done it. It's very easy.
Never happened to me. Never.
Oh, never, Ken. Never.
Myrick, that stuff never happens to us. Are you having fun with this podcast?
Oh, well, I hope it comes across like I am. But the answer is yes. people might think this is corny, but I have a career mission. And my career mission ever since my time at Yale has been to promote the centrality of the brain with respect to all areas of health. I think if people can start to think of the brain as just like any other organ system, it can work really well some days, and then some days it might not. We can all see that when we don't sleep at night. Our cognition is not as good the next day. So it's an organ system, and it happens to be, you know, responsible for our behavior. So I think, you know, that part gets stigmatized. But, you know, we have to recognize that given the fact that the brain is so important in the body, I mean, obviously we can't live without it, obviously, and you can't transplant it yet either. So the bottom line is that this is the only brain we've got. We need to love it, respect it, and nurture it, and recognize that it is just as much a part of the body as any other organ system, and that health conditions like, you know, for cancer and cancer treatment, autoimmune disorders, migraines, seizures, thyroid problems, liver and kidney problems, all of these can affect the brain, and the brain needs to be healthy in order for the rest of the body to be healthy as well.
You know, we're doing a podcast today and we're talking over Zoom, and probably many of us are spending days on end on our computers. Are there particular issues related to technology in the brain that you see?
Well, yes, I would have to say so. We actually just did a wonderful survey and some focus groups of our faculty, staff, and trainees on campus in the department, really focusing on how much time they spend in Zoom and video chatting, whatever mechanism that they use, and with patients in meetings, and really measuring things like burnout. When does telehealth work in psychiatry and when it doesn't? And I mean, I can say that, you know, I don't think we'll ever go back to how we were doing it before, where a relatively small percentage of our patient visits and meetings was done through this kind of Zoom or Microsoft Teams or whatever you use. And so now we are doing practically 90% of it through this mechanism. And we want to be smart about it. So again, we're learning what patient populations this works for the best. And I have to say the providers are not all the same. I start to really get kind of green around the gills around 5 to 6 hours into Zoom sessions. And so I'm working now to try and figure out how to get my balance. And so I think it is a very personal thing as well.
I'm trying that same thing.
Yeah. So what's working for you, Ken?
Not much right now, to tell you the truth. I need to disconnect.
Yes.
The only thing that's working for me is it's Friday.
Oh, yes, it is Friday.
Well, we here at See You on the Air are big fans of Mind the Brain. We enjoy and appreciate what you're doing, and we appreciate having you here today, Dr. Neil Epperson, Chair of the Department of Psychiatry in the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ken. It was a real pleasure.
The University of Colorado comprises 4 campuses, Boulder, Colorado Springs, Denver, and the CU Anschutz Medical Campus in Aurora. To learn more about CU, go to www.cu.edu. Thanks to our producer, Kathy Buten, and audio engineer, John Arnold. I'm Ken McConnellog, and we'll see you on the air next month.
University of Colorado.